This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
So it's chapter 38 of Bereshit. And this, the period that we're skipping is the period of the selling of Joseph, the plotting of the brothers against Yosef, and the selling of Yosef, and that's the, all of that takes place. Now, Yehuda plays a part in those discussions, and that links into to the beginning of chapter 38, so we just need to take a brief look at that. Yehuda, the brothers decide to pass the death sentence on Yosef. And the reason they pass the death sentence on Yosef is because Yosef is threatening their spiritual survival, in their opinion. And the reason they saw it that way is they felt that Yosef was alienating their father's affection to the brothers, to the other brothers, that Yosef was assuming for himself the role of dominant heir, although he wasn't the firstborn. And their previous experience was that the fathers each had one heir. Avram had many sons, but only Yitzhak was the heir. Yitzhak had two sons, but only Yaakov was the heir. So their belief is that as they saw this relationship between Yaakov and Yosef developing, that Yosef would be the only Jewish heir, and that they would be removed from the Jewish nation. And they felt that was for no reason other than that Yosef was alienating the affection of the father. And just as when a person is threatening our physical existence, we're allowed to defend ourselves by killing that person if necessary, so if a person is threatening our spiritual existence, in theory, we could do the same. Threatening the spiritual experience means that the person is prohibiting us from being our religious selves. So clearly we have to give our lives rather than change our religion, certainly to a non-monotheistic religion. But if the only way we can keep our Jewish heritage as a nation is by waging a war, then we have to wage a war, and we have to kill. We feel strongly enough about our Jewishness to be willing to fight for it, and fighting means killing. And that's quite important. And it's an idea that we're forgetting a little bit in the Western world, and in some ways that's good and in some ways it isn't. That there are some things that we're willing to fight to the death for. And one wonders today what those things are in Western society and in our society. What are the things that we as individuals or as a nation, what would the American nation fight to the death for? I guess its own territory if it were ever invaded. Liberty and democracy, I don't think to the death. Send a few troops in if we're sure we're not going to lose too many. But quite a lot of discussion, and when we do start losing too many, we run back very quickly. So that we're not going to fight for the death for. What would we fight for the death to save the Jews? Or anybody else for that matter? No. Kosovo wasn't about saving people, because if it was, then we should have been in East Timor. Kosovo must have been about something else. And the Iraqi war was not about saving little Kuwait. It was about something else. So the things we're really willing to fight for are material things. At the end of the day, that's really all the West is willing to fight for, when its material survival is being threatened. And fighting for means, what do you mean you're willing to fight for? Fight means I'm willing to fight until I die or you do. That's what fighting to the death means. That's how strongly I feel about it. And a Jew or the Jewish people feels that strongly about its Jewishness. They will fight to the death for it. And have many times. And the brothers fought Yosef to the death. They were not going to be pushed out. They were not going to be deprived of their Jewishness by a manipulative brother who was alienating them from their father. And he was doing this, and he was criticized for that, and he suffered for that. We discussed it on Monday night, and when we did in this year the story of Dinah, and we did it again a little bit last week when we discussed Esau, the concept of of stealing a woman, the concept of manipulating a person's feelings. It's possible to do that with men as well, not only in the men-women relationship, that one can alienate that one, and that's part of what Lashon Hara does if it's subtle. One can fracture a relationship. Two people can be having a really good relationship, and one correctly placed word, never mind the perpetual water treatment, just one correctly placed word starts introducing a doubt. And the doubt grows into a bigger doubt, and then all sorts of things start happening that start giving credence to the doubt, and then you start interpreting all sorts of things in light of the doubt, and it becomes very, very unpleasant. You can have two of the best friends, and all you have to have is one person saying to one of the friends, "Haven't you know what she says behind? Don't you know what she says behind your back? Are you really that naive? Do you really think she likes you?" It's all about that's what he said, and then everything starts getting interpreted in light of that, and the relationship can be fractured. And one sees it happening, in families. On the one hand, one would think families is a place that it doesn't happen, but families is the place where it happens most because there's most to gain. And one sees it happening in inheritance. That's where one sees it happening, both in spiritual, in terms of spiritual inheritance, and in terms of material inheritance. And the brothers accused Yehuda, the brothers accused Yosef of building a relationship with their father at their expense. And that's the easiest way to build relationships. To build relationships at somebody else's expense is much easier than building it through your own investment. To create dissatisfaction with an existing situation and just to be there at the right time is the easiest way to create a relationship. And that's creating a relationship at the expense of another party. And they decided that was capital, that there was no way they could live with it. They tried to reason with him, they tried to work with him. There was nothing they could do. They saw their father getting more and more distant from them. They saw their father getting closer and closer to Yosef. They held Yosef responsible. They sat down as a Beis Din and discussed and debated the matter and concluded that he was guilty and that the punishment for that is death. And so they decided to kill him. Yehuda steps in. The idea of selling Yosef to the Ishmaelim and ultimately to Potiphar was Yehuda's idea. So why does Yehuda step in if the decision was that this is something that serious and is deserving of death, and that is the correct punishment, that is what is just? Why does Yehuda step in and persuade them after they've issued their sentence, after they've sentenced Yosef to death, and they've in fact thrown him into the pit? And throwing him into the pit was Yehuda's idea, was Reuven's idea. Instead of killing him, throw him into a pit and let God finish off the job. That they're having, after having done that, Yehuda steps in and says, "No, let's get him out of the pit and let's rather sell him." The reason that Yehuda uses in that debate is that we brothers have decided we would dip Yosef's coat in the blood of a calf, and we would tell the father, "This is what we found. Obviously, something's happened to Yosef." Says Yehuda, "If we cannot stand up for our decision, then there's something wrong with our decision." That's Yehuda's reasoning. "I can't argue it with you on justice, because on justice everything seems right. All I know is we're not willing to stand up for it. We're not willing to take the responsibility for it. We're not willing to be accountable for it. The fact that we will lie to our father rather than tell him of our decision means that there's something in our decision that we're not comfortable with. So and if that's the case, then killing Yosef under these circumstances would be murder. If there is anything wrong with our decision, it's not a question of it's a wrong judgment. If a judge incorrectly sentences a person to death, that judge is guilty of murder. Nothing less than that." And therefore Yehuda says, "I'm concerned. We went through all the rational debates, and it all seems right. But at the end of the day, we're not willing to say to our father, 'Yosef was threatening us, we had a court case, we decided, we killed him. That's what we did.' We're not willing to say that, and if we're not willing to say that to our father, then we ourselves are not fully confident in the correctness of our decision, and therefore our decision could be murder, so we better not do it." That was Yehuda's argument. So Yehuda displays a characteristic here of anything you're not willing to be accountable for, you shouldn't be doing. That's the Yehuda characteristic that Yehuda's put forward.
It wasn't confident enough to just say, let's take him back home.
No, and he agreed that he had to be eliminated, that Yosef had to be eliminated in distance, and that the question was the danger of committing a murder rather than a sentence of death. Correct, but at least he's saying, but then he's saying, so we're not 100% sure that what we're doing is right, maybe not, so it's wrong, so what we're doing is wrong. So what is our sin then? We've kidnapped our brother. That's our sin. That we can live with. If we're wrong, and that's the downside, we can do tshuva for that, but not for murder. So murder, a death sentence of death, you'd better be 100% sure, not 99, 100. A sentence of life imprisonment, if you're 99% sure, you can live with that. You can still get him out, and you can get back, and you can reverse it. There are things you can do when, if it's found to be wrong. And then at worst, you've locked him up for a few years when you shouldn't have been that serious enough, but it's reversible. But death is not reversible. And don't do something irreversible that you're not willing to be accountable for. That's how confident you need to be in what you're doing.
In their decisions, then, they must be thinking long-term as well, like how this affects, you know, the descendants, those kinds of things.
Yes. Nevertheless, this is something that has to do.
Also long-term, we're named after Yosef's dad, and so therefore, that's probably what we should stand for, the accountability.
But the fact that we named up Yehuda, this accountability, this extreme emphasis on accountability is a Yehuda quality, and is primary for the king, for royalty, and that's why the house of David comes out of Yehuda. And we're going to see another example of Yehuda's thinking in this area in the part that we're going to discuss today and next week. Did it? Because on the rest of them, they felt that they were equally valued by their father, and could each stand on their own feet. So in their case, he would not be able to pick one, and if he did, it wouldn't be at the expense of the others. There was no competition about that. If he decided that Yehuda was there or Reuben was there, the brothers had a sufficiently good relationship that they would have worked with him there. But there's no way that they could have worked with Yosef. The Yosef relationship was exclusive, and that was the threatening part. So it's not that they thought that there could only be one. They saw the pattern of one continuing, Yosef making that assumption and positioning himself to be the one rather than one of the team. And that they weren't able to. Were they right?
Would it have
happened? No. Okay. So now let's get into the series. So Vayehi Ba'esahi, it was at that time Vayered Yehudo Me'es Echov. An interesting phrase that literally it means, and Yehuda went down from amongst his brothers, Vayetad Isha Dulamirush Mochiro, and he camped, he set himself up in the territory, in the area of a man from Adulam whose name was Chiro. Rashi points out that this, and he went down from his brothers, is not just a geographical removal, but Lelamed Shehoriduhu Echov Megidulosoi Kesheru B'Tzoros Avihem. That the brothers demoted him. The brothers were furious with Yehuda. And what caused the brothers to be furious with Yehuda? So what? They were going to kill him. Yehuda says, let's sell him. They sell him. They dip the coat in blood. They go back to the father. And now they're furious with Yehuda and they expel him. They remove themselves from him. They demote Yehuda. Why? Kesheru b'tzoros avihem, when they saw their father's pain, Omru, they said, Ato amarto lemochro, you told us to sell Yosef. You had such stature with us that had you said to us, return him, we would have done that too. You thought that all you could get us to do was to sell him. You thought we would never buy into anything more than that. You underestimated your own authority, and we hold you responsible for not selling us. Well, that's an amazing thing, because now I'm holding you responsible for not selling us. We made the decision. And they're saying, halachically, we decided to kill him, and you were part of that decision. you then questioned our decision based on the fact that we weren't willing to stand up to our father, and you recommended we sell him. The reason Yehuda, as it emerges here, recommended selling him rather than returning him was because he never believed that the brothers would listen to him. He was doubtful enough that he could swing this one, but at least he gets them off the murder thing. So he persuades them, let's sell him. That way there's much more, it makes much more sense. They say yes. They go back and they see how distraught the father is, and the brothers now accuse Yehuda of not exerting his authority and persuading them to send him back. No, because they're saying on our, in terms of our foresight, in terms of us, we said that the right thing would have been to kill him. You had an angle of accountability. I know they're probably coming up with the same issue that you came up with. We're not even accountable about selling him. So why did you stop there? Using your argument, you should have gone all the way. And you would have actually said, but I never thought you guys would listen to me. And they said, then you don't know who you are. And we're demoting you because of lack of knowledge of who you are. Humility is not thinking that you're less than you are. Humility is knowing who you are. And if you are too meek about exerting yourself when you have that authority and that capacity to impact and to persuade people, and you hold back, you are held somewhat accountable for that. If you know that you could change something or someone and you don't, you are accountable. Now, you remember when we discussed responsibility, I explained to you that in the area of responsibility, one person's responsibility doesn't free the other one. That doesn't mean they're not responsible. They are punished too. But they're saying, as our leader, we're firing you. Because as our leader, you should have taken your logic to the extreme and fought for it and argued for it until we'd agreed, and we would have agreed. So they're demoting him. They're not saying it's your responsibility that we sold him. All they're saying is, as a leader, you failed us, and therefore, Huriduhu Migdulosu, they removed him from his position as leader because they felt he had failed them. That's the issue, isn't it? Sorry? So what's the question? Why didn't they say if Reuven would have persuaded us not to? Reuven apparently would not have been able to swing it, and they don't even suggest that he could have. As far as Reuven didn't even say don't kill him. Reuven just said kill him this way instead of that way. And Reuven had in his mind that he would come and save Yosef out of the pit. But Reuven knew that he couldn't swing them anymore. You would have thought he couldn't swing them anymore. To underestimate your capacity to impact is a failure of leadership. That's the point they're making. It's not that you take full responsibility. Of course we are responsible. But as a leader, you failed in underestimating your capacity to impact. And that's unforgivable. Yes, exactly. Right. We must assume that. Otherwise, they would have done the same with Reuven. And that's part of being a king, is knowing it, the impact that you can. What did Shaul lose his kingdom for? At what point did Shaul lose his kingdom? When he blamed his action on the people. They persuaded me. And Shmuel says, you could have persuaded them. They respect you. You're a king. You have that authority. To underestimate your capacity to impact as a leader is as serious as to overestimate. Overestimating it is arrogance. Underestimating it is just a lack of effectiveness.
This is totally inconsistent. Buddhist agreeing initially with the brothers, but this is a capital crime.
Right.
Let alone, you know, why are we talking about this? Returning to our brother, we'll talk with him yet once again, suggesting the seriousness of the schism that he's creating. Now, the suggestion is that he's going from judging his brother to be guilty of a capital crime worthy of death,
right,
to, you know, not culpable for
anything.
Yeah.
Why this extreme?
Yeah, that's
very good. But all they're saying is using your argument. Your argument is logically and legally the outcome is death. But there's something in us that isn't allowing us to take accountability for that death. Therefore, we have no right to issue that sentence. And exactly as you, as some of you are. But in the same way, we're not even taking accountability for selling him. We're not even going to our father to say, we sold him. We were going to kill him. You're lucky we didn't. We're not even doing that. We're saying an animal ate him up. So using the same logic that you used for not killing him, you should have used for not selling him. But you chickened out. You got cold feet in the middle. and you only went halfway with your own argument because you didn't believe we would buy it from you. Not because you didn't believe in the argument. Your argument is, don't sentence a person to something that you're not willing to take responsibility for and say, that's what I did and this is why I did it. And that's the big difference between a murder and a death sentence from an ethical perspective. A murder is, I shouldn't have done it, it was wrong, I was furious, I was angry, I was whatever. But hopefully there is a sense somewhere of murder isn't a good thing. A judge should never feel, I shouldn't have done that, I wish I didn't do that. A judge should never feel that. I did what was right. I sentenced him to death, and that was the right thing, and I'm proud of it. I don't feel happy, but I'm proud that I issued the justice correctly. If you're not going to be able to do that, if you're going to issue your sentence and then cover up and say it wasn't really me, it was the jury, and I didn't really agree with it, and that I had, then you have no business being a judge, if you don't have the shoulders to carry it. So their accusation is, you didn't give us a legal argument, because you couldn't. So then either buy into our legal argument and kill him, or give us this kind of moral argument, but then the taking that to its full length is give him back to his father. The compromise in the middle lost everything. We caused the father the same grief as we would have had we killed him, and we didn't kill him. So what did we gain? What kind of a sentence was this? And you'll say, yes, but we wouldn't have voted. We are accusing you of not realizing what influence you could have over us. With your power of intellect and your reasoning and your stature and your personality, you could have persuaded us and you didn't. And that's the issue with him. So Yehuda has now been demoted. Now, what is the impact on a person when he's demoted? Fired, when a person loses his job. Sorry? It's horrible. How horrible? It's depression. It's very, very serious. A person loses his self-esteem, he loses everything. And you see that in Yehuda. So he removes himself and he goes off into the fields. He takes his things and he goes. He doesn't just stay on. Vayarsham Yehuda bas ishkanani yushmo shua. And he saw, and Yehuda saw there a Canaanite woman, the daughter of a Canaanite man, whose name was Shua, and he marries this woman. There were no women other than Canaanite, he clearly converted her. According to the Rashbam and others, Canaanite has two meanings. Canaanite can mean a Canaanite woman, and it can also mean, as Rashi says, a socher, a trader. So some say it was that he married a Canaanite woman, and some say he married the daughter of a trader, and her name was, and the man's name was Shua. But Tahar, so he starts establishing a family there. That's how he, in his loneliness, he moves away, starts a family. But Telet Bain, and they give birth to a son. Baikroshmo Er, he was called Er. But Tahar Oid Batelet Bain, Baikroshmo Oinon, and he had another son, and he was called Oinon. Vatosef Oid Vatelet Bein Vatikrosh Mo Shelo. She had a third son who was Shelo. Vayobi Chaziv Bili Dato Yitoto, and that took place in a place called Chaziv. Vayikach Yehuda Ishol Eir Bechoro, and Yehuda took a wife for Eir, his daughter. Right, so this is the Shidduch system working. He finds the most suitable woman. They're living in a bad area, Canaanim all the way around, and he is active in the choice of the wife. Ushama Tomar, and her name is Tamar. So he notices Tamar. Tamar was in fact the daughter of Shem. Shem, the best of the sons, was Shem, and his daughter was, one of his daughters was Tamar. So granddaughter of Noach, Tamar, and Yaakov, and Yehuda takes it. Vayehi Eir b'chol Yehuda ra b'inei Hashem. And Er, the firstborn of Yehuda, was bad in God's eyes. Vayebiteyu Hashem, and Hashem killed him. What did he do so badly? He wouldn't allow his wife to fall pregnant, is what he did. So he practiced permanent contraception. And this is quite an interesting part of the Torah, because our whole view of contraception has its roots over here. He practiced contraception, but there were two things that he was doing wrong. The one was the reason for which he was practicing contraception, because when we look at the value of an action, what we've got to look at is not just the action, but also the reason for which, and secondly, the method. that he was using. And oral contraception, by the way, is very ancient. The Gemara talks about it. It's very ancient. It was rediscovered in the West in the 1960s, but the Gemara refers to oral contraception already 2,000 years ago. And more. So there were various forms of contraception. He takes a contraception which involves the destruction of seed, and he does it. The most important thing that God is angry about is the reason for doing it. The reason for doing it is the Tamar is very beautiful, and he just doesn't want to ruin her beauty. And it's his decision, not hers. She wants children, and he doesn't. And he wants a beautiful wife, and he's afraid that by her becoming pregnant, she will lose some of her her youthfulness and her beauty, and therefore instead of using the passion of companionship and love between a couple to create children and family and future, he uses it for self-gratification and will allow no future element to come into that relationship whatever, and God objects. Vayomer Yehuda lo Oinon. And Yehuda said to Oinon after Er had died, Bo el eshes achicho v'yabei moiso, marry your brother's wife. This is where we get Yibum from. This is the first case of Yibum. Brother has died childless. The widow is there. You should marry her. V'hokem zero lo achicho, thus establishing a line of continuity for your brother. The whole concept of Yibum, it seems very old. This is the first time that it's recorded. The Ramban and others suspect that it might even have existed beforehand, that this was so that it was taken as a very obvious and simple thing, that although one is not permitted to marry one's sister-in-law under normal circumstances, in the case of the brother having died without children, there is an obligation to marry the sister-in-law. In those days, we don't have that today. And the reason is that there is a spiritual continuity through the process of Yibum. So although it's now the brother marrying the wife, the widow, he's doing so to continue his brother's lineage. And that allows the neshama, that allows the spirit of his brother to continue a presence in the world through the new generations. So that the progeneration of spiritual continuity is not a function only of a physical connection, it's also an intentional connection. So provided the brother does it with that intention, that what I'm doing is preserving a continued lineage, a spiritual lineage of way back for my brother, then Yibum works. However, Vayeda Oinon ki lo yeh hazora. Oinon knew that the seed, the child, would not be his, and that the spiritual inheritance would not be his. This would all go through Er, and would be attributed to him, not through Oinon. V'hoyon, therefore, in Boel Eshes Achiv, as he had relations with his brother's wife, v'shiches arzo lebiltina somdeo la'achiv, he also interrupted the act of sex so that his semen spilt and there was no way she could fall pregnant. So he is using his brother's technique. And in other words, the continuity is not in the having children. The continuity is in the prevention of having children. All of this and with contraception and so on, it's important to know and to understand that the Torah is the most of all the religions, from a theological and halakhic point of view, is the most, I want to use the word flexible, but the most understanding with regard to the use of contraception. In the time of the Torah and the Gemara, until much later, women used to feed their babies for 2 years at least. So there was a natural spacing of 3 years. Women did not fall pregnant while they were feeding. So there was a natural spacing of 3 years. That today, sort of a baby every year is unnatural and was never recommended by the Torah or never desired by the Torah. Women who are capable of doing that and love doing that and fine and doing that, great, that's a big brocha. But nobody should feel that that's what God expects of them. God does not expect that of anyone. And it never was that way. So now comes the question, well, today we don't feed for 2 years, and even if we do feed for 2 years, women do sometimes get pregnant when they're feeding. So what does all that mean? Well, all that means is today there are forms of contraception that are halakhically permissible in situations where contraception is permitted. So there are a variety of situations where contraception is permitted. And what is important is the circumstances under which it's permitted and for what reason. And what really revolves around is the health of the mother, the physical health, the emotional health, and of the family. The capacity of the family to manage and to handle and to be okay. And just as with Yehuda, it's important not to overestimate one's capacity, it's also important not to underestimate one's capacity. So sometimes you'll find a couple that's got one child and cannot imagine how you can possibly manage with more than one. And the truth is, when you've got one child, you couldn't manage another one. And when you've got two, you can't imagine how you can manage three. And so there has to be a realism in it, that when there's a situation that either physically or emotionally it's draining on the couple, on the woman, then the Torah is very liberal in its understanding of the use of contraception. But then there are some halakhic issues. Each form of contraception has halakhic pros and cons, and one has to look at it. But this particular form is the least desirable form of contraception because it's unnatural. It interrupts the sexual relationship. It's destructive. It's not loving. There's something very negative and destructive in this form of contraception. So God's anger is in the method of contraception and the reason for it. Why are you not having a proper relationship with her? Because you resent the fact that it will be your brother's child. And that's the very purpose of Yibum, is that it's your brother's child, that it's not your child. So God is angry with what he did. And he died too. So now, Yehuda has lost two of his sons. Yehuda says to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, Shvi almon obeis avich. Remain a widow in your father's home. Now, go home. Remain a widow. Don't remarry. Ad yigdal shelo v'ni, until my third son Shelo is a little older. Ki omar pin yomus gam hu keecho. I don't want to marry him off to you while he's too young, because he might die too. But when he's a little older, we'll get you back and you'll marry Shelo. Yehuda seems absolutely determined to keep Tamar in the family. Why? Okay, that's the romantic outlook. And what else? And what's the Kabbalistic outlook?
He must have known something.
What would he have known? Yes, from Tamar. You can see that the relationship between Yehuda and Tamar is going to produce a David. It doesn't enter his mind that it's him. So the only possibility is his son. So he marries her to the first son, doesn't work. Marries her to the second son, doesn't work. The third son is still a young child. So keep her available for the third son. But one thing is determined, is that from this relationship is going to come Mashiach.
Did he know what
his son was
doing?
I don't know. Batelech Tamar, Batesh, so she went and stayed with her father's house, at her father's house. Vayirbu hayomim vatomus Bashua ishes Yehuda. Then Bashua died, Yehuda's wife. All this time, Yehuda seems to have been isolated from his brothers. He seems to have lived a very lonely, very successful, financially successful life. But there doesn't seem to be that much contact with his brothers. He's mourning the fact that his failure, that he could have saved Yosef, that he could have persuaded his brothers. He feels he's failed as a leader. He goes off and he has this builds this family. He's lost two sons, and now he's lost his wife. Vayinochem Yehuda, and Yehuda was comforting himself. Vayal al goz zeitzonu v'chiro reyu adu lometim nosa. He and Chiro went to celebrate the shearing of his sheep. It's at this time. We won't do the psukim, we have to leave it for next week. That Tamar hears that he's in the area, that he's celebrating, and that Tamar, who seems to understand as well as he does, that out of this relationship has to come something great, presses herself up and positions herself as a prostitute and attracts Yehuda. And that's one of the most difficult pieces of Tanakh, no less difficult than the pieces we're doing on Monday night at the moment. How Yehuda becomes attracted, why Yehuda has a relationship with this girl, what he's thinking at the time, and how the outcome of that relationship is managed, and how that leads to the founding of the House of David. But we'll do those verses in the Chazal next week.